Okay. So we're talking about relationships between the different areas of geometry, topology, and analysis. So there's many things that intersect these three topics, and I'm going to talk about three of them. So let me start talking about what these three things are. Quick overview. So geometry is concerned with properties like distance. And so, whenever you're doing mathematics, you always want to, it's like the population doubled in size since the pizza came. So talking about geometry, what's topology loosely? So you can think of this as kind of rubber sheet geometry. So now we allow stretching, and we think of two things as equivalent topologically that we can get from one through another through kind of the geometric operations, but now also stretching. And so kind of the classic example is that the surface of a mug is topologically equivalent to the surface of a donut. So mathematically, the shape is called a torus, because you can get one from one to the other through bending. Okay, but of course, these are different than the sphere, right? Surface of a sphere, which doesn't have any poles. Okay, right? The mug and the torus each have kind of one handle, that's topologically equivalent, whereas the sphere does not. Okay, and analysis maybe is something that's most familiar to most of you. That's really just kind of a fancy word for calculus, differential equations, differential operators, and so forth. Okay. These are the three topics, three kind of different branches of mathematics. And so I'm going to talk about how these are interrelated. And so I'm going to discuss three big theorems or areas, ideas, each one at the intersection of two of these. So the first thing I want to talk about is the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, and this tells us how topology restricts what geometry we can do. This lies at the intersection of topology and geometry, right? I mean, I think it's kind of most intuitive that topology and geometry should be related, since topology is kind of just a weakening of geometry. And then the next thing I want to talk about is Durand's theorem, theorem of cohomology, which relates topology and analysis. And this tells you that you can detect many topological things, so namely the number of holes a space has, by looking at the number of solutions to a certain actually partial differential equation. Okay, so this sounds maybe kind of fancy. This is actually something you've probably seen before in multivariable calculus. For surfaces, this is really just a count of how many curl-free vector fields there are that aren't gradient vector fields. And then lastly, the last topic has this very catchy name, this catchy question, which is, can you hear the shape of the drum? So the question is, if you can hear, if you have perfect, pitch, and you can hear every, different frequency the drum can emit, is that enough to determine the shape of the drum? Right? Different shapes might emit different frequencies, but does the set of all frequencies determine uniquely what the drum is, right, geometrically? That was question asked or made famous, at least in the 60s. Okay, so before I get into those, let me talk about some of the key notions in these different disciplines. So in geometry, we want to study the curvature of something. Okay, so let's think how we can define curvature, how we can quantify how much something is curved. Okay, let's start off with the curvature of a curve. Right, so mathematics, proofs are great, but also good definitions is a large part of math. So how should we define the curvature of a curve? Well, let's start with a circle. Circle is a nice, this curve. It should have the same curvature everywhere, right? Now, the bigger the radius, the smaller the curvature is. Or if you're on a circle that has a really big radius, near a point it looks almost straight. Or is it that was a very small radius, right, be curving very tightly in that larger curvature. Let's just define the curvature of a circle, and we're going to use R to be 1 over R, so that they're exactly inversely related. Okay? And now how can we, so starting with this, how do we define the curvature of an arbitrary curve? Well, this is going to be a function on the curve, right, because, general curve, is going to be, can be flat in some places, highly curved other places and so forth. The curvature is independent on where we are. So how do we do this? Well, let's look at a point x. How do we assign the curvature of this curve at the point x? Well, we know what curvature of a circle is. So let's just approximate the curve near x by a circle and then define the curvature of the curve at that point to just be the curvature of that circle. And this circle is called the osculating circle. So this is a circle that's tangent to the curve at this point x, and that approximates the curve. Right? So it's like kind of like in calculus, right? You want to assign slope or something to a point so you approximate the curve at a point by a line, because you know the slope of a line. Here, we're doing a similar thing. We're going to approximate the curve at a point by a circle. And that will enable us to define curvature, just knowing what the curvature of a circle is. Okay, so this is our working definition of curvature for curves. How do you actually compute this? Well, and then kind of alternative picture of this is to think of curvature as an acceleration. Okay, so if we have a curve, we can parameterize it. Then if we take the derivative of that, that's like the velocity vector field, that's a vector field on the curve, we call t. Different parameterizations can give you different, are going to give you different tangent vectors. But there's kind of a unique one, the one that has speed 1. This is the arc length parameterization. Canonical parameterization of any curve. Okay, so let's take the arc length parameterization of the curve. Differentiating that parameterization gives us t, the unit tangent vector field along the curve, and then let's just define the curvature at a point to be the magnitude of the derivative of the tangent vector field. So the derivative of the tangent vector field, that's like acceleration, right? Tangent, it feels like velocity, differentiating that as acceleration, and then taking its norm is the magnitude of acceleration, which is a vector, right? And so, you know, here, for example, we see the tangent vectors, you know, aren't changing much. It's pretty flat here. It's going to have low curvature. Whereas here, we have kind of a lot of acceleration. We have more curvature. Okay, so this is useful for computing. There's other definitions of curvature you might have seen in calculus that are all different ways of computing the same thing. Okay, so that's curvature of a curve. Now I want to go up and define curvature of a surface at a point. So how do we do that? Again, we want to bootstrap, you know, that we know how to do this for curves. And so one definition of what we can mean by curvature at a point on a surface is defined in the following manner. So we're at this point x, which here is where this normal vector is emanating from. And now let's consider all normal planes at x. So these are planes that contain the normal vector. Okay, necessarily they're going to intersect the surface near that fixed point x in a curve. Okay. Right, there's obviously, I mean, there's going to be infinitely many normal planes. Here's, you know, a picture of a few, right? And each one's going to intersect in a curve through x, and then we can compute the curvature of those curves using our definition of curvature of a curve at a point. And then here we also want to use the sign convention. So the definition I gave for curvature of a curve was something positive. The norm of a vector, or 1 over the radius, right? Those are all positive numbers. Or possibly 0, like a line, for example. But here I want to use the sign convention that if the curve curves away from the normal vector, like here, let's just say this has negative curvature, and then it curves in the direction of the vector, we'll call it positive curvature. Okay, so we have a bunch of curvatures, infinitely many, one for each normal plane. And now let's just look at the smallest value, you know, most negative, if there's negative values, and the largest, and multiply them. Okay? So here's not, you know, before it's not so clear this is the right notion. I mean, it turns out this is the good definition. Okay, and then these two different curvatures are called the principal curvatures. And it turns out that the curves will always be perpendicular, like in this example, or these intersect perpendicularly. Like this one has smallest curvature is negative, this one as the largest, which is positive. And we'll take that as our definition of curvature. So again, this is a function on the surface. At every point, it assigns a number that measures how much that surface is curved at that point. Okay. And by the way, you know, feel free to ask any questions in the middle if something's confusing or just curious about something. Yeah.
How do you know it'll actually attain the largest and smallest curvature?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's different ways to view this. It turns out this. I mean, another way to compute this is at every point on the surface, you get this map called the shape operators. It's a linear transformation that kind of contains information of all these normal curves, and that this product is actually going to turn out to be the determinant of that thing, which is it's a map between R2 and R2, so it's deterministically finite. From this definition, maybe off the top of my head, I can't give it reason. But that's a good question. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at some quick examples. So this one example we saw on the last slide, the saddle surface, this has negative curvature. Again, right here, this curve is negatively curved. Positively curved. It doesn't matter which way we choose the normal direction, because that would just be the sign of each one, and since we're taking the product, it would remain unchanged. Okay, the cylinder actually has curvature zero, which might be a little unintuitive. But the reason for that, right, is so if we look at this point, right, we have this one curve, the circle, that's going to have curvature. Then in the orthogonal direction, we have a straight line, which has zero curvature. So the product has to be zero. Okay, this is consistent with, we want to say that, a rectangle made from paper is the same thing as a cylinder, right? We can bend one into the other, right, without stretching or anything. And so if the curvature is to be an invariant, those better have the same curvature. Okay. And now a sphere is an example where the curvature is positive everywhere. Actually, curvature is constant, which makes sense. We actually compute explicitly because any normal plane is going to intersect the sphere on a great circle. That's a circle on the sphere that has the same radius as the sphere. So here I'm calling the radius of the sphere big R. So each of these curves, these great circles, by definition, they have curvature 1 over R. So the product, 1 over R squared, is the curvature of the sphere. That's constant. So you see curvature can be negative, 0, positive, and it can change. Certainly on the saddle surface, the curvature isn't constant. Okay? Whereas in the last two, curvature actually is constant. Okay, so let me give a very relevant theorem. So this is called Gauss's theorem of gradient, and this actually relates to pizza, which is very relevant. Took me a very long time to figure out how to put emojis into LaTeX. Okay, so this theorem says that the curvature is actually a geometric invariant. Okay, in other words, this is independent of how we kind of rotate or translate or bend, kind of the paper bending, a shape in an ambient Euclidean space. Another way of kind of phrasing this is that this is just intrinsic, and that you can measure this just by staying on the surface. Okay, so like if there was an ant, a smart ant. And the smartest Gauss, just crawling along the surface, it could measure the curvature. Okay, it wouldn't have to go out to the ambient space. Okay, and so here's a real world example. I was watching everyone closely as they ate their pizza to see if they did this. This pizza is pretty sturdy. So we actually use this. Well, some, especially if you have the big New York style pizza, right? The pizza is flat, has curvature zero everywhere. Right, but if you pick it up, what happens? It tends to slope down, right? And so, what do we do? Well, we fold it up, right? We fold the crust up into like a parabola type shape, right? So now, I think I should just demonstrate. Right? Oh, this is perfect. See, if you just hold it here, you're screwed. Right, so we make this parabola type shape here. So at this point, now this curve, right, there's curvature, but the whole Gaussian curvature has to remain zero. Right? I'm not stretching or anything. So that means I need to get a line here. Okay, so that right line is curvature. zero curvature, that the product has to remain zero. Okay, so that's why this trick works. It's a nice real world application of deep theorem. Okay, so that was the invariance of geometry. Let's talk about topology. So key invariant, and most people will be looking at what are called compact surfaces. So these are closed, topologically unbounded. So like these things. Okay. And the key invariant is the genus, which we call it, you know, by G. And you think of this as the number of handles it has. So a sphere is genus 0. There's no holes, no handles. A torus is genus 1. And then if we kind of conjoin two tori, we get a genus 2 surface. And then it turns out that the genus classifies what are called closed and also orientable surfaces, that there's a consistent notion of outward normal vector for these surfaces. Okay. Of course, and also you can get the surface of an arbitrary genus, right? We can keep conjoining tori and get a surface with any genus we want, any positive integer or a negative integer. Okay, and then another key invariant that's related to this is called the Euler characteristic. This is chi of sigma, and this is, here I can just take this as a definition, that's 2 minus 2g. Okay. Okay, so you might have heard Euler characteristic before, maybe in terms of polyhedra or graphs as the number of vertices minus the number of edges plus the number of faces. Okay, so this seems pretty different how I defined it, just in terms of the genus. But these are actually related, and we can actually use the same formula to compute the Euler characteristic of a surface, and actually more generally any topological space. And so there's many ways to think of this via called simplicial complexes, or I'll be working with CW complexes. And a CW complex is a way to build up a surface by starting with very simple pieces, namely points, intervals, and squares. And if you want higher dimensional things, you know, not surfaces, then you can get cubes and hypercubes and so forth. Okay, but we just talk about surfaces, so we have these three pieces. So we have points, we think of as vertices, intervals as edges, and squares as being faces. And so the structure of how you can glue these things together to create a surface gives a CW complex structure on that surface. And then what I call the Euler characteristic, 2 minus 2g, is the same thing as this alternating sum, b minus b plus f, where b is the number of vertices in this CW complex, e is the number of edges, and f is the number of faces. And it's actually really the same Euler characteristic of a graph or polyhedra. So let's see just two quick examples of what these structures look like. So what's a CW complex structure on a sphere? Well, we can start with a point, okay, and then we can take a face, and now, so we take this rectangle, and if we just collapse its boundary by identifying them, then we get a sphere, right? So we map the entire edge of this rectangle to the point that identifies every point on the edge, every other point on the edge, and that's going to cause, that's going to give us a sphere topologically. Okay? We're closing it up. Another way, you know, if you think of like kind of deleting a point here, okay, stretch it apart. Okay, so that's a CW complex structure on the sphere. You know, there's other ones, these structures aren't unique, but you get the same Euler characteristic in this invariant. And let's just check. So here we use one vertex. Here we didn't need to use any edges. And here we use one face, so the Euler characteristic is 2. On the other hand, the genus of a sphere is 0. There's no holes, and so 2 is also 2 minus 2g, g being 0 in this case. Okay, so this is consistent. Let's look at a torus. So a torus can be obtained in the following manner. So first, let's start with one vertex, and then two edges, two intervals. So now we can glue, right, we can attach these intervals to this vertex, forming two circles. Right, so I attach this one by putting the two ends both and close up this interval to a circle. And then I do the same thing here. Okay, and then that's going to give us this picture. These two circles that are joined at a single point. Okay, it's called the one skeleton. So once I have that, how do I get the torus? Well, now to this one-dimensional thing, this conjoint of two circles, I can attach a single rectangle using the following diagram. Right, so if I look at this, so these arrows mean I identify the top and bottom, and then the sides, right? So I fold this up, that's going to give me a cylinder, identifying this and this, and then when I identify these two circles that are left over, I close it up to get a torus. Okay, so this is how I'm going to attach this face to this one-dimensional thing, and that will result in a torus. Okay, so now here we've used one vertex, two edges, and one face. So the number of vertices minus number of edges plus number of faces is 0. 1 minus 2 plus 1. On the other hand, the genus is 1, right? There's one handle, one hole. And so this also agrees. Okay? So it's consistent in these two cases. And so in general, this is true. And so, for example, to get a surface of genus G, you can do a similar construction we did for the torus, where instead of having just two edges, you take two G many edges. Okay? And then the other characteristic is going to be 2 minus 2. Okay, so now let's take the Gauss-Binet theorem. So it says that for any compact, which means closed and bounded surface that doesn't have boundary, the integral of the curvature over the surface, so here this is a surface integral, maybe I should put a double integral, is 2 pi times the Euler characteristic of the surface. Okay, so this left-hand side is something that's geometric. Right? The curvature depends on the shape geometrically, not just topologically. Whereas the right-hand side, is something topological. So this gives us a constraint on the possible curvature functions. Right? I just can't have an arbitrary curvature function on a surface because I have to obey this equation. Okay, so I'll show you some examples in a minute to clarify what I mean by that. Whenever you see a theorem, it's good to do a quick check. Check it against something we know. So let's look at the sphere. So if we have a surface that's topologically a sphere, that means the genus is 0, and the Euler characteristic, remember that's 2 minus 2g, is 2. Okay, so the right-hand side for a sphere, anything that's topologically a sphere, is 4 pi. Okay, now on the other hand, and this is geometrically a sphere radius r, so not some stretch sphere, actually an actual sphere radius r, then we know that its curvature is constant, it's 1 over r squared. So now when we compute this integral, right, we just pull the 1 over r squared out, we're just integrating the area element, that just gives us the surface area, right? The surface area of the sphere radius r is 4 pi r squared, so the r squares cancel, and then we get 4 pi, okay, which agrees. So this is just a quick check. Okay, but for example, if we deform the sphere some weird way, stretching it, pulling it, whatever, we get the same thing topologically, right? Topologically, this is the same thing as the sphere. Since we're made out of rubber, we'd be able to, bend this up and bend these things and get a sphere, okay, of arbitrary radius. But geometrically, this is very different than a sphere, right? The curvature is changing. There's some places where the curvature is positive, like in this region. Whereas over here, we have negative curvature. We have one curve going like this, one curve going like this. Negative curvature. Two places where there's zero curvature. For example, here, it's basically a line. So the curvature function on this is pretty wild. Nonetheless, the integral of it has to be 4 pi. Okay, kind of an amazing thing that this happens. As another example, let's look at a topological torus, right? So, as you said before, you know, the surface of a donut and the surface of a mug are both topologically the same. They're both porous, but geometrically they're very different. Right? For example, this shape around the bottom of the mug, we have this fairly large two-dimensional region of zero curvature. Right? Whereas we don't have such a region on the surface of the donut. Right? Nonetheless, whatever these curvature functions are, the integral, kind of like the sum of it, has to be zero. Okay? So no matter how you stretch or bend this torus, any amount of positive, any area that has positive curvature has to be balanced out equally by the amount of negative curvature so that the integral becomes zero. Okay? And then a pretty big restriction. And it's worth pointing out that there's actually a way to put the torus into R4 so that the curvature is zero. It's called the flat torus. This won't embed into R3. This is actually kind of the most natural geometry on the torus if you view the torus as a Cartesian product of two circles. And you take kind of the product metric, then you get this thing. But again, there's no way to kind of, we allow ourselves to go in, any arbitrary dimensional ambient Euclidean space. There's no way to bend the torus so that we get something that has, say, positive curvature everywhere, right? Because then the integral would have to be positive and not zero, right? Or negative curvature everywhere. And everything has to balance out the amount of positive curvature and negative curvature to sum to integrate to zero. Right, any questions on that? So that was the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. And so now I want to talk about Durand cohomology, which is at the intersection of analysis and topology. And so this will enable us to determine topology from differential equations. Okay, so let's recall this fact that I'm sure you all saw in multivariable calculus, which is that we have a vector field on the plane that has zero curl, then it has to be a gradient vector field. That is, you can find some potential function so that your initial vector field, big F, is a gradient of little f, little f being some function on R2. Okay? The converse of this statement was kind of the easy thing to check, that the curl of a gradient is zero. Right? Remember, if you do gradient and then curl, it always gives you zero. Right, and this is saying the converse, that if you have something that has curl zero, then it has to be a gradient vector field. Okay, so this is true for vector fields on R2. However, this is not true for arbitrary subsets. Right, if I have a vector field that's just defined on some subset of R2, this might not be true. And so here's an explicit example. So if we remove the origin from R2, we look at this vector field. Right, so this is well defined on R2 minus the origin. The only problem is, when x and y are both zero, which would make the denominator zero. It clearly doesn't extend to the origin. The limit as x and y goes to zero doesn't exist. And so the plot of this looks like this. Okay? It blows up at the origin. Okay, so you can check that this has no curl. Okay. However, F is not a gradient vector field. So one way to tell that something isn't a gradient vector field is by integrating it over a closed loop. Right? So by the fundamental theorem of line integrals, integrating a gradient vector field around a closed loop, or around any loop, you can use the potential function to evaluate that integral by just doing F at the endpoint minus F at the beginning point. If you have a closed loop, the curve starts and stops at the same point, so that's necessarily zero. Okay? So like if you have a conservative vector field going, if you end up where you start, you do no network. Okay? And so you can just compute fairly straightforwardly that the integral of this along the unit circle is 2 pi, which is well known to be non-zero. So this cannot be a gradient vector field even though it has zero curl. Kind of amazing fact is that this vector field I wrote is essentially the unique. So in the following sense, that if I have any other vector field with zero curl, I can write it uniquely as some multiple, some constant multiple of this vector field plus a gradient vector field. Okay? So, in other words, you know, gradient vector fields are kind of trivially curl-free. And so if I just think of gradient vector fields as zero, maybe you've done some linear algebra, you talk about quotient spaces. So if I look at kind of curl-free vector fields quotiented by gradient vector fields, I get a one-dimensional thing that's just spanned by that single vector f. And the other is just going to be a constant multiple of it. Okay, so in this case, you know, we can see that this has one hole because we have one such, you know, up to scale, constant scale, we have one such vector field that is in a gradient but has zero curl. Okay, and actually, this is a more general result that if we remove k points, here we just remove one, if we remove k, then we get k many vector fields, f1 through fk, such that any curl-free vector field can be written uniquely as a linear combination of the f1 through fk plus some gradient vector field, okay, uniquely. Okay, so again, if we kind of quotient out the space of all curl-free vector fields by gradient vector fields, what we get is something k-dimensional. It's spanned by these guys. Okay? They're linearly independent. Okay, so here we see that the number of holes is exactly the number of linearly independent vector fields that have zero curl, but which are not gradients. So here we have analytic information, which was a count of kind of non-trivial solutions to this PDE, namely the curl operator on the vector field being zero. This gives us exactly topological information, the number of holes with region S. Okay, and this actually generalizes a lot further. One small generalization that we can also use for surfaces. So for surfaces, curl also makes sense. For higher dimensional things, not so much, but there's an analog. But for surfaces, this is also true. So for example, here, if we look at these vector fields on the torus, you check that these have zero curl. I mean, intuitively, right, what is curl? Curl is kind of a measure of the infinitesimal rotation of the vector field, right? Like, if I have something here that's kind of fixed, you know, and its center mass is fixed, would the vector field rotate? And I see that it wouldn't. However, so even though these vector fields have zero curl, they're not gradients. Can someone see why these can't be gradients? Vector fields. Right, so gradient vector fields have the property that they're flows. So if I start at a point and then I follow the vector field, if that's a gradient vector field, I can't get back to where I started. Right? Why is that? Well, unless the vector field is zero. These vector fields are zero. Why is that? Well, where does the gradient go? So if I'm flowing along the gradient vector field of a function f, that put the gradient is the direction where f increases the most, right? So I'm going along the gradient. That means f has to be increasing. So I start here, f is increasing. If I end up back here, right, the value of f has to have changed. That doesn't make sense, right? Start at the initial point, f has a definite value there. So gradient vector fields can never have closed loops as you flow along them. So these vector fields can't be gradients unless they have zero curl. And I only drew two here because that's kind of the only ones that exist to adding in some gradient ones. And so if I have a surface of genus G, there exists exactly too many curl-free but non-gradient vector fields on the surface such that any other curl-free vector field can be written as a linear combination, those two G many ones plus some gradient vector field. Again, you always add a gradient vector field to get something that remains curl-free. So here, again, we get this quotient space of curl-free vector fields on the surface, quotient out by gradient vector fields is of dimension 2g. Okay, so we're recovering the genus of a surface by looking at the number of solutions to a certain differential equation, modulo, and the trivial solution, which would just be taking gradient vector fields for any function. Okay, so actually all this stuff generalizes to arbitrary manifolds. So manifold is a space that locally looks like Rn. This uses a theory of differential forms, and this is called Durand cohomology. So Okay, so now the last thing I want to talk about is this question of can one hear the shape of a drum? Okay, and so this is the final intersection of analysis with geometry. The question is, if you had, you know, perfect pitch, would it be possible for you to tell the shape of a drum just by hearing all the possible overtones that can come from that drum? Okay, because the frequencies that can be emitted from the drum determine the shape of the drum you need. Okay, so mathematically, how do we model this? Well, we think of the drum, you know, some shape. You know, the membrane of the drum is some shape in R2. Okay. Any shape, right? We have some region in R2. Okay, obviously, usually drums are going to be just this unit disc or some disc of some radius in R2. Right, but let's look at arbitrarily shaped drums. And now, as you hit it, the amplitude, which, so I call this function u, so u x y t, that's the amplitude of this at time t and position x y in R2. Okay. And so, kind of by physics, this amplitude function satisfies the wave equation. Every time it makes sense, right? And waves satisfy the wave equation, which is this. So two time derivatives of u equals the Laplace operator on u. That's not the Laplace operator. And the Laplace operator should actually have squares here. Right? Laplace operator is second order. Sorry about that typo. Okay, and then furthermore, right, the ends of the drum are fixed, right? The interior of this is what's vibrating. And so we have this partial differential equation with this boundary condition, that for all x, y on the boundary, the amplitude is fixed at zero. Okay? So this is the kind of initial value problem that that this amplitude of a drum must satisfy. Again, the overtones, so things would kind of have, you know, pure frequency and time. So these are solutions that look like this. Okay, so it's some function which I call big U of the spatial variables times E, and again, this should probably have a I there. Okay. Well, not being fact checked on Twitter, this is streaming like the debates or something. In the locker room, we we don't put an I there. There should be an I there. Okay, so if we plug this into here, the wave equation, we see that this function big U has to satisfy these equations. Okay? The Laplacian of u plus omega squared times u is 0, and then the boundary condition just does that, right? We have to be 0 for points x and y on the boundary. Right here, omega is just a constant, non-zero constant. You also get this from separation of variables, which is the technique you might have seen in solving PDEs. Kind of the only technique where you can really solve PDEs by hand. Okay, so then the drum can emit a frequency omega if there's a non-zero solution to the system for u. Right? A zero solution u would just give us function little u is 0. We're interested in non-zero solutions. Right? And so having a solution now is going to depend on the actual value of omega. Okay, and this first equation, well, especially if I moved the Laplace operator on u to the other side, this would be an eigenvector equation. Right? Another way of saying this is that we're looking at, we want omega squared to be an eigenvalue for the operator minus the Laplacian. It is an eigenvalue, eigenvector problem. Okay? And then the set of all these eigenvalues, that should be a y, obviously, is called the spectrum of this operator minus the Laplacian on omega. So mathematically, the question, so this was made famous by Mark Heck in the 60s. It goes asked by Bachner much earlier. So it's, if you know the spectrum of this operator on omega, then do you know what omega must be geometrically? You tell me what that shape is. Okay, so I think it would be useful before talking about that more to look at the simpler problem of hearing the length of a string. So let's look at the one-dimensional analog of this. Sorry. Okay, so we have a string of length L, a positive number, And so a region, you know, there's not many interesting shapes on a line, right? Especially if we can just look at connected things that we just really have intervals. Right, so let's look at the interval of length L. So the boundary course is the point 0 in L, and now we need to solve this initial value problem. So now this just becomes a differential equation. And that's one of the nice things about one dimension is that differential equations are a lot easier than partial differential equations. Okay, so you have this initial value problem, and this can be solved explicitly. So the general solution to this differential equation is, so we have two independent solutions, sine omega x and cos omega x, and the other solution is a linear combination of them. But this hasn't taken into account boundary conditions. Right? So at 0 and L, this function has to be 0. So if I plug in 0 for x, I just get that cosine thing, so that tells me C2 must be 0. And then on the other hand, if I plug in L for x, right, so C2 is 0, so I don't have the cosine term. And so that sine term, I get C1 sine of omega L is 0. So if I get a non-zero solution, the only way that can happen is if sine omega L is 0, which means that omega L is a multiple of pi. Okay? So omega L is pi k for some integer k. It's the only way I can get a non-zero solution. So this, these solutions look like this. The graph of sine of omega L for variance omega that satisfies this. Okay, so now in this case, what's the spectrum, right? If I just solve this equation for omega squared, I get these numbers, right? And so here we see that the spectrum determines L. So I can hear the length of the string, right? I can just look at the smallest value, the smallest frequency I can hear. That's going to be pi squared over L squared, and then I can solve for L from this. Okay. So you can hear the length of a string. Okay. So it's going to be the smallest the smallest eigenvalue, smallest frequency. Okay, so now let's be kind of some intuition, some idea what this question is about. So it turns out that you cannot hear in general the shape of a drum. So it took a while to prove. Again, this question was made famous in the 60s, and then it wasn't until 1992 that there was a counterexample. So here's two regions in R2 that are the same, that are geometrically different. I mean, these shapes are definitely different, but the Laplace operator has the same spectrum on these shapes. So if you made drums out of these, they would emit the same sounds. Okay, so it's not enough just knowing the spectrum of the Laplace operator is not enough to determine the shape exactly. And let me just remark, so this question can be generalized both to higher dimensions and also in the case of what are called Riemannian manifolds. These are kind of the most, or these compact Riemannian manifolds, these are kind of the most general compact topological spaces where you can do kind of calculus and geometry on. And then you can consider ones without boundary, you still have a notion of a Laplace operator, and so you can still ask the same question. When does a Riemannian manifold without boundary that's compact determined by the spectrum of the Laplace operator? And so actually, this was known before, but the simplest, so this was known that it's not possible to kind of hear the shape of a Riemannian manifold in general. This was actually predated when this question was made famous in a paper of Milner. Milner, kind of the OG of geometry topology. And his example is of two 16-dimensional tori, so topological torus, n torus is just kind of n Cartesian products of the circle of itself. We call this torus a surface as a circle times itself. You do that 16 times, you get a 16-dimensional tori. So you have topologically two 16-dimensional tori that had the same spectrum, but were different geometrically. So the geometry on them was different, right? We saw the coffee mug and the surface have done it in two different ways to do geometry on the same topological space. And then there's 16-dimensional versions of these that have the same spectrum but are different geometrically. Okay, let me just say kind of a positive result, something you can hear. So you hear the area of a drum. And maybe that's not surprising given our one-dimensional example where you could hear the length. The length is really the only invariant of a shape in one dimension. Whereas in two dimensions, you know, the area isn't going to determine the shape clearly. But the area you can hear. And so all the way back in 1911, Weil proved this asymptotic expression for the eigenvalues of the Laplace operator. So this means that as you go up to infinity, as k gets bigger and bigger, this approximation, the error in this approximation goes to zero. So asymptotically, the growth of the eigenvalues look like 4k pi over a, where a is the area of omega. And so in this case, the area is determined by the spectrum. Okay, so so let me just conclude by saying, you know, we've really just scratched, you know, a very little surface of, no pun intended, of interactions between these areas. You know, a lot of mathematics in the past, you know, century, 50 years has been, you know, at the heart of interactions. So, for example, you know, the Tiesinger index theorem. The proof of the Poincaré conjecture, right? Poincaré conjecture, you know, is just a purely topological statement, but its proof uses geometry and analysis in an extremely non-trivial way. Hodge theory, theoretical physics string theory, Monodi phases, etc. I think this is really kind of all over the place. All right, so thanks for your attention.